Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives. Please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
As we watch world events unfold and fulfill Scripture, it's hard to believe anyone could doubt God and His Word are real. And yet there are so many who either question or completely refuse to believe it. The God Who Speaks is a 90-minute documentary that hits the doubt head-on with evidence that proves God is real and His Word is the ultimate authority. Watch it anytime and invite others to watch with you. Just visit stream.afa.net. That's stream.afa.net.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Tuesday, September 23rd, and no, I do not plan on watching Jimmy Kimmel's return to late night tonight. That announcement came from Disney and ABC that they will have him on air tonight, and many ABC affiliates, including Sinclair, say thanks but no thanks. So the decision to bring Kimmel back was, according to Variety, approved by Bob Iger, Disney CEO, and Dana Walden, co-chair of Disney Entertainment, according to a person familiar with the matter. Variety goes on to say the executives acted based on what was best for the company, this person said, not on external factors. Yeah, well, I just think that it must be so great to be a leftist, right? You know, you get canceled for the weekend, you spend 3 days of vacation, you know, complaining, and then you get to go right back to work. So we'll see if the mea culpa that is anticipated from Jimmy Kimmel will be sufficient. In my opinion, likely not, but we'll see. Anyway, turning to a lot more important news, according to Real Clear Investigations and Weaponized Scoops, the new Russiagate documents expose media and government collusion. So recently, declassified documents indicate that people close to former FBI Director James Comey and Democrat Senator Adam Schiff were connected to leaks of classified information to prominent reporters designed to portray Donald Trump and his allies as being in league with Russia. So written in 2017, the FBI documents expose how selected Washington reporters, including reporters from The Washington Post and New York Times, scored a series of Pulitzer Prize-winning scoops in 2017 by repeating false and inflammatory leaks during President Trump's first term. So for more on this, let's welcome in Scott Uhlinger, who is a former CIA officer. And Scott, what does this mean for this investigation and these brand new leaks? What is the overarching, like, big story here?
Well, obviously, the story is basically the continued collusion, to use the word they started, of government and the media. You know, if you look at who's who in Washington, in the sewer known as Washington, there are an unbelievable amount of high-level media executives who are married to at least former high government officials. And now, I'm not a lawyer, but I have been reading some things that indicate that there are some statute of limitations issues coming up with some of this, of these associated offenses. I'm hoping that maybe some of these newer revelations will be the final impetus to get Pam Bondi and the Justice Department moving forward on this, because whether it's in Mississippi or in Pennsylvania, people want to see these people behind bars. And personally, I am sick and tired of seeing this corruption go unpunished.
Yeah, I think the word that everybody has been saying since we first learned about Spygate and all of this is accountability. And to say, okay, well, it took so long that now the statute of limitations bars a lot of these prosecutions, still doesn't bar things probably like a censure from Congress, you know, other types of, you know, even if it's not necessarily a criminal prosecution for, you know, for statute of limitations issues, there are still other methods that could at least acknowledge and provide some accountability for this. But it feels like it's just a lot of media reports and we're all mad about it. And the Democrats are like, eh, it happened. But, you know, like to right. quote Hillary Clinton, right. what I, difference now does it make?
Right. Yeah. You've made a couple of good points. The I think one thing we need to start doing is start looking at this the way Democrats do, and that is bringing someone before the court. The punishment is the process, meaning this is what it means to me, is that instead of making sure you have the perfect case against someone, which then never materializes, drag them in front of court and for some minor violation. In other words, just humiliate them in court. And even if it's tried in D.C., and even if they get off scot-free, so be it. But at least drag them in front of the court. So in other words, you know, we try to have like, you know, like perfect is the enemy of the good. Let's just get people in front of courts and accuse them. Like, for instance, the statute of limitations, again, I'm not a lawyer. I don't want to be a lawyer. But like
Wise.
Comey and such. But maybe prosecute for lying in front of Congress if you can't get them for the other things. Because maybe that's more recent and is not expiring under the statute of limitations. But that's what they need to do. They need to stop worrying about perfect cases and never getting it in front of the docket and start moving forward quickly, because people are losing patience. And I said in April or so, I said they better start having prosecutions by September, or people across the country are going to start getting really angry.
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree with you that, you know, the Democrats are willing to prosecute, you know, Donald Trump basically for a parking ticket and for anything, and make that the top story in the world, drag him before, you know, New York courts and courts all across the country for totally frivolous things. And yet it seems like unless there is something that reaches the level of, you know, the highest possible prosecution, Republicans aren't willing to hold anyone accountable. And it's not about just going after their political opposition. They need to stop taking that as a deflection, and to say, you know, hey, we have to be fair and we're the party of justice. Okay, fine. But meanwhile, you're letting these people basically get away with everything that they have because you're not willing to go after them at all, unless, as you said, Scott Uhlinger, they have a perfect case. And so so where does this go from here in terms of the investigation? Because if there are statute of limitations problems, and yet we're seeing that there are new revelations, this is just going to continue to upset people. I mean, just like the Epstein files. I mean, I'm frankly sick and tired of hearing about the Epstein files, because I'm thinking it doesn't actually matter. Until something results in a prosecution or someone held accountable, I don't care.
Right, exactly. That's the problem. And so, you know, there's been plenty of people. There's, even if the Justice Department isn't willing to do the job or whatever, there are, I have seen plenty of very bright people on X posting literally a lists of the violations of all of these people, of every violation of the law they've committed. And so, you know, let's take a page from that. I mean, like I said, we need to move forward. Actually, I think one that they should move forward relatively easily, been getting a lot of attention, is Ilhan Omar. She clearly lied on her citizenship application. And I think stripping her of her citizenship and kicking her out of the country would go very far in making people realize we are serious about this, because our whole immigration policy right now would be defined by kicking her out because she is obviously a lawbreaker, right? She's married her brother. It's been out there for 8 years and no one has done a thing about it. Even Congress will not even, the Republicans who literally censured their own, one of their own, who's now in like isolation for 87 days on Long Island, that congressman, I can't forget his name, but they won't vote for, they won't vote to censure Omar and strip her of her committees. I mean, the corruption is just biblical, literally.
Yeah, I mean, and it's as you said, I mean, there's no way, in my opinion, that Congress or this administration is going to go so far as to actually strip her of citizenship when they won't even strip her of her committee assignments. I mean, the fact that that hasn't been done by Speaker Johnson, even just for lying, especially, but even just for the things that she remarked about Charlie Kirk, and you know, some of the things that she's done that have been just totally outrageous lies. The fact that that's not even come up and he's not even speaking to that suggests that, you know, this Congress isn't really that serious about getting the business of the American people done. But, you know, we're seeing, so the Secretary of State Marco Rubio could do that. He seems to be a more of a fighter and more in at least the mold of Donald Trump in the sense that he's willing to get things done. What could the Secretary of State perhaps, you know, act on this more unilaterally?
Actually, I think that would be possible. That would be possible for him to definitely move forward like that. So that's actually another good thing. To point out, one thing I want to point out, a little insider baseball, I think that the listeners will be interested in, is one thing, you know, so everything's been going very good, I think, overall. I mean, you know, we really don't have cause to complain. But, you know, as a former retired CIA station chief, you know, I observe different things that I'm not happy about. And that is what we're not seeing yet, and hopefully we will, but I just don't know about this, is, you know, Trump cannot lead, or Rubio cannot lead all the change himself. That's the problem. He's only one man, an incredibly capable man, but he's only one man. We have to rely on the subordinates. And what I am seeing in the FBI and the CIA is not encouraging. Okay, I guess some people have been removed from the FBI and CIA leadership ranks, but the bottom line is the CIA director, for example, is a political appointee. He's a congressman from Radcliffe, is a congressman from Texas. So he brought a lot of his cronies in, and that's fine. Nothing wrong with that. But what I haven't seen is I know a number of high-ranking, conservative intelligence officers who were determined to pursue real reform in the agency. In fact, I know of one guy who worked for the Heritage Foundation who got out of the agency as recently as 2019. He wrote a document, like a 75-page treatment of exactly how to reform the CIA. And I texted him recently and found out, to my shock, this administration, meaning Radcliffe and the CIA, have not even spoken to him, which is unbelievable. If they don't call me, you know, I'm just a small little guy. I'm a minor character. If they don't call me, okay, that's fine. But they're not calling people who should be leading reform. And as someone who served in the military for an entire career and the CIA, you know, I'm well aware of the fact that if you cannot pursue reform if you have the same people in the organization who led to the destruction of that institution in the first place. It's ridiculous to reform with the same people who brought you to the pitiful state you're in. And unfortunately, I think that's what we're seeing. We need a lot more retired MAGA-type officers brought in who have no axe to grind, who don't care about their careers, who are determined to reform their agencies, than keeping in these corrupt officials who perpetrated things like what we're talking about with Comey and the Russiagate hoax.
Yeah, and that makes so much sense that, you know, you can't reform with this same mindset of the deep state that has led to everything that we are discovering. And so I have a little more hope, at least for the FBI with Kash Patel and Dan Bongino, who have really cleaned house a lot in the last, you know, 7 months or so. But Congress as well needs to have reforms and changes that would make prosecutions more viable either legally, like longer statutes, or procedurally, having better evidence collection procedures in connection with, you know, the FBI, the DOJ. I mean, these agencies, it's like they're not talking to each other. They're all just pointing fingers, and it's ultimately frustrating. But in just about the last minute or so we have with you then, Scott Uhlinger, I mean, so do we all just kind of give up and say at this point and say, all right, well, the leaks are frustrating, but, you know, nothing's going to happen?
No, certainly. Like I said, we have to be creative. And heck, if the Justice Department isn't willing to be creative, people on Twitter or on X are, because they will do the research necessary, because I'm sure you can exploit the law to continue to prosecute these people, the Comey debacle, after, let's say, a nominal end to the, to the legal proceedings. I'm sure that other legal offenses can be found which are beyond the statute of limitations, which can be pursued. And it has to be aggressive. I mean, look at the way they went after someone like Trump. We need to be as tenacious and following, justified offenses against the
Americans. Absolutely. All right. Well, we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, the White House made a big announcement yesterday, taking steps to address autism. The argument was put forward by Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, the director of the NIH, Dr. Marty Makary, the FDA commissioner, and Dr. Mehmet Oz, the administrator of CMS. And this is coming from Politico. President Donald Trump and HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. challenged us to break down the walls between our agencies so we can rapidly address the health crisis facing the American people. Today, we announce an approach to provide relief for children on the autism spectrum. And the portion of the announcement that garnered the most attention was that dealing with acetaminophen over the past few years, and this is quoting from that press conference, observational evidence has suggested that when moms take acetaminophen during pregnancy, especially close to delivery, it is correlated with subsequent diagnosis of conditions like autism and ADHD in their children. Peer-reviewed data from large-scale cohort studies, including the Nurses Health Study 2 and the Boston Birth Cohort, find this association. What should parents do in light of this evidence and lack of clear alternatives? We, the Trump administration, believe acetaminophen should be used judiciously in pregnancy and under medical supervision of an obstetrician as a practical, prudent medical approach that balances risks and benefits. This caution could be extended to infants and toddlers. So let's welcome in Raw Egg Nationalist, who is our good friend and goes by that moniker. He is an author and writes a lot of nutrition-related content, and you can follow him on X. So Raw Egg, happy to have you back. And, this seems to me like at least there was some balance between saying, hey, this is what the studies suggest, and we're not trying to scare new moms. We're just trying to show what the evidence is providing. What did you make of this announcement?
It's good to be back speaking with you, Jenna. So, yeah, I mean, I was very encouraged, actually, by this big announcement from the White House, from RFK Jr. Donald Trump was there. Jay Bhattacharya, Marty Makary was there as well. We expected the stuff about Tylenol. That had, had been reported in the news weeks before that HHS were preparing to issue new guidance about the use of Tylenol during pregnancy on the basis of studies that suggest that actually, yes, high doses of Tylenol during pregnancy could be linked to autism. So we were expecting that, but it was, this is new. This is new guidance from HHS on the use of Tylenol. It was balanced, like you say. They didn't try to scare anybody, but they did say, nevertheless, look, this is potentially one among many causes of childhood autism. And one of the, I think the main takeaway really from the announcement was that there's going to be a fundamental change in the way that HHS approaches autism and other forms of chronic disease as well. I mean, I think So not only did they talk about Tylenol, RFK also talked about this therapeutic drug called leucovorin, which has shown significant promise actually for ameliorating the effects of autism, especially in children who show a folate deficiency. So that was another thing that they talked about, folate deficiency as a potential cause of autism. But more broadly, RFK Jr. talked about a new approach to autism. He said that HHS would finally stop smearing and gaslighting parents who actually just want to know the truth about their children's illness. You know, he did quite a funny thing where he said, you know, leftists and liberals say, you know, believe all women, and yet they won't believe, they refuse to believe the mothers of children who have autism, who believe that their children have been injured, especially by vaccines. And he gave this figure: between 40 and 70% of all mothers whose children have autism believe that their children were actually given autism by vaccines. So this does mark a turning point. I mean, it's just the beginning. That's what I think we have to bear in mind. This is just the beginning. This is the beginning of a new approach that's going to focus on environmental factors rather than genetic factors. So RFK Jr. said, look, HHS has been focusing on genetic causes of autism, and that would be like looking at the causes of lung cancer and not focusing on cigarette smoking. And that's going to change. So overall, I mean, I think it was a big announcement. Some of it was expected. The Tylenol stuff was expected, but there was new stuff. And also President Trump actually played an interesting role during the press conference, because RFK Jr. was very measured. He, you know, he stuck to the science. He talked about the studies, what they show, what they don't show. And then President Trump kind of came in his sort of inimitable way and started talking about the childhood vaccination schedule, about people he knew whose children had been affected by vaccines. And he started to sort of throw into question, you know, whether children should be given the hepatitis B vaccine, because hepatitis B is a sexually transmitted disease, and why would a child need a vaccine against that? So it was a very, very interesting affair, actually, with lots to be positive about for the future.
Yeah, and I think that's a really great point to highlight, that this is a new approach, and that rather than how I think a lot of the left is framing this as, oh, you're just scaring young moms and this is overwhelming. Every mom that I know wants all information to be able to make the best decision for herself and her family. And that's why more information generally is always better. And that's what informed consent means. And so, you know, it's I think a very good thing that HHS is looking at a variety of factors. They're not just going along with the status quo. And they're not also just saying that, you know, big pharma should be ignored and we should just assume that more medication is always better. Looking at these types of environmental factors and looking clearly at the risks without the reverberation of clearly, you know, where Tylenol, you know, came out and made a statement and all of this stuff. They're not caring about that. And that to me is a good thing, because we also need to, I think, have more trust in our institutions, that these studies aren't just being bought off basically by big pharma, and that we can actually trust some of these results.
Yes, I think that's a very good point. I think this press conference was as much about announcing, you know, sort of new findings like with the Tylenol and the leucovorin, as actually a step towards re-establishing some kind of trust between ordinary people and government, because people do have huge distrust in government. They and quite rightly, I think, after the pandemic, but also because of everything that we know about the relationship between government and big pharma, by, you know, as a result of lobbying, the incredible power that big pharma has over government because of the millions and billions of dollars that are spent on lobbying and funding individual politicians as well. So, yeah, reestablishing trust. I mean, that's that's something that RFK Jr. has to do, because, I mean, government obviously does have an important role to play in people's health, in regulation, in promoting healthy lifestyles, etc. But people are so distrustful, and rightly, that major change needs to happen. And I think this actually could very well be the beginning of real major change.
And that's really encouraging. This is exactly, I think, what voters wanted from HHS. This is why a lot of us were encouraged with Secretary Kennedy being the pick. And, you know, in fact, when he didn't get, you know, any kind of, you know, role, I guess, you know, drive in terms of the presidential election, and, you know, when he was running, he didn't get a lot of momentum there. Seeing his focus, though, specifically on these issues of health, I think he's in the perfect role. And I'm really encouraged that there's another 3 years of opportunities that he's going to have to then shape, you know, a lot of this that hopefully will continue, you know, far past just this administration. But what else then can we expect beyond, you know, some of these announcements? It seems like as you and I have been talking about HHS and, you know, kind of this overall strategy, there has been more of that strategy now released. So in your view, are they focusing on the right things, and what can we expect moving forward from HHS?
Yes, it looks like they're starting to focus on the right things. I mean, the first few months of the Kennedy tenure at HHS, then we've seen some kind of flashy wins, but they've actually been quite easy wins. So we've had corporations, processed food producers in particular, saying, you know, oh, we're going to remove red dyes, we're going to remove these additives. And they did that voluntarily to show willing. That stuff's easy. You know, these processed food corporations are scared of what RFK Jr. could do to the way that food additives are regulated, to the, you know, to the way that to the nutritional information and advice that's given, to programs like SNAP, etc. So actually, RFK Jr. has a lot of power, and it's a question of whether he is prepared to use it and to go against these vested interests. I mean, there's a famous saying, you can't please all the people all the time. And somebody is going to be displeased by, you know, whatever RFK Jr. does. And HHS and the FDA and all of these other regulatory agencies for too long have pleased corporations and the rich and the powerful at the expense of ordinary people. So now it looks like, yes, we're going to see some fundamental change, and actually the needs and priorities of ordinary people are going to come first, as they should do. I mean, I think RFK Jr., you know, at this press conference, then he announced that there's going to be a lot of research is going to take place. They're going to commission gold standard scientific research, the kind of research actually into the causes of autism and other forms of chronic disease that should have taken place 25 years ago when this problem really started to get very, very bad, but didn't, because of vested interests and the power of the big pharma lobby. So, and big food and big ag. So I think what we'll see definitely is we're going to see more revelations about the causes of chronic disease, not just autism, but all the other forms of chronic disease that are afflicting Americans today. I think that's going to be a big part of the program over the next 3 years, is, you know, new research telling us things that the old research didn't tell us. And that, I think, will guide policy fundamentally. Policy is going to be guided by this new research. I mean, I think, yes, it's good to see that there is a plan forming. That was one of my initial criticisms, actually, of Maha under Kennedy after Trump was elected, that there didn't seem to be a long-term plan. And I think what we need is we do need a generational plan to be laid out now, because, of course, it's taken 100 years. It's taken the better part of a century, certainly 70 years, for Americans to become this unhealthy, to become basically the most unhealthy people in the world. And so actually, it's not going to take 3 years to research reverse that. It's going to take longer than 3 years. It will take multiple administrations. So what I'd like to see developing, as well as concrete measures, is a game plan for you know, what's going to happen under J.D. Vance 2028 and then, you know, 2032? You know, how are we going to carry on this Maha agenda and ensure that actually whatever RFK Jr. manages to achieve in this administration doesn't just get reversed in the next administration or the administration after that? So I'm encouraged that there's long-term thinking, but I think that we need some codification of that. We need a big document that kind of lays it out and makes it clear that this is a generational agenda.
Absolutely. And also learning from our past mistakes. And in fact, you wrote a piece in InfoWars that's titled "From Bad to Worse, the mRNA COVID vaccines really might cause cancer." And you're probably hearing Todd in the background lauding this this morning. Mm-hmm. We're babysitting our little friend Jack. He's over with our, so I have three dogs in the background today. They're all playing and it's a great time over here. But this piece is talking about how the COVID vaccines really might cause cancer. And this is, of course, something that, you know, President Trump hasn't really wanted to walk back. But at the same time, I think with the HHS, they are walking it back. And this is a good thing.
Yes. Yeah. This is some very worrying research that was done actually by Dr. Peter McCullough. They looked at the case of a 31-year-old woman who had aggressive stage 4 bladder cancer. And they analyzed her genome. She'd taken the Moderna mRNA COVID vaccine, and they found that genetic material from the vaccine plasmid, so that's the loop of genetic material that's introduced into the body to get it to produce the spike protein and then, you know, cause an immune reaction. Parts of that genetic code had been integrated into her genome. And the researchers showed that this had caused massive, massive dysregulation of a variety of different genes in her body that were involved in protection against cancer. So the body has various mechanisms to protect against cancer, and they'd been dysregulated by the introduction of this genetic material. And so this is, I think, the first documented case, well-substantiated case of somebody actually taking up genetic material from these experimental vaccines. And it's very worrying. And it looks like, yes, it did prompt her to have this very rare, very aggressive form of cancer. So I think HHS really needs to look into this. We've got all these documented harms. We've got the VAERS data about side effects, about rare cancers, and all the other side effects of the COVID vaccines. And I think HHS now needs to take seriously the possibility that actually these mRNA vaccines aren't safe. And I think if they do further research, which they should, and they substantiate these findings, then I think the mRNA vaccines need to be withdrawn from use straight away. I mean, Donald Trump shies away from this, of course, because, you know, he's responsible for Operation Warp Speed, which brought the COVID vaccines to market quickly. I don't think it's not his fault. I mean, he wasn't responsible for the research. He was advised by medical advisors, including Anthony Fauci, and I think he was given bad advice. I think he will probably shy away from walking it back himself, but RFK Jr. has the power to walk back the use of these vaccines, and he already has. So we've seen updated guidelines from HHS about the use of the COVID vaccines. You know, they're not being recommended now by physicians for anybody who is under 65 or has a anybody who doesn't have some kind of serious comorbidity, a serious chronic disease that would put them at genuine risk from the coronavirus. So there are big changes happening, but I think on the basis of this study, which is very, very worrying indeed, then they could go even further, and perhaps really they should.
Yeah, well, we need to take a break here, but thanks so much, Raw Ignatius. There's so much more that I could ask you on this. We'll have to have you back to talk more about these findings about the mRNA vaccines. But in the meantime, if people want to read this article, it's at InfoWars by Raw Ignatius, and the title is "From Bad to Worse, the mRNA COVID Vaccines Might Cause Cancer." And you can read through that. This is why in my home state of Florida, the Florida Maha commission. This is really important that states, along with HHS, are looking at all of these things and not just trusting the institutions and the studies that have been going on for the past, 20, 30 years or even longer. We really need to get to the bottom of a lot of these health issues, look at everything fully, and make sure we're making the best decisions for ourselves and our family with medical freedom. We'll be right back with more. I want you to picture this. Her name is Kayla. She is 17, alone, terrified, and pregnant. Sitting in a clinic, tears blurring, thinking abortion is her only option. Until she was offered a free ultrasound, paid for by a hero just like you. The moment Kayla heard her baby's heartbeat, the decision was made. And today, her little baby boy, Gabriel, is thriving because preborn walked with Kayla every step of the way. Now, multiply that by 38,000. That's how many babies preborn has helped save just this year. How many mothers preborn has come alongside with practical and spiritual resources to make motherhood possible. But here's the most important thing you will hear today. Their goal is to save 70,000 babies by the end of the year. And they can't do that without us. Every $28 provides that ultrasound, the moment everything changes. Will you be the reason the next Kayla chooses life? The reason Gabriel fulfills his destiny. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or donate securely at preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, some good news for accountability, at least here in the free state of Florida. Our education commissioner in Florida found probable cause to sanction a Clay County teacher who posted a callous, unconscionable comment about the assassination of Charlie Kirk. Here is what our Florida commissioner had to say. Cut four.
Our Office of Professional Practices Services investigated a teacher specifically in Clay County who made callous and unconscionable comments on social media celebrating the death of Charlie Kirk. Specifically, she said, "This may not be the obituary we were all hoping to wake up to, but this is a close second for me." And attached to that post was an article explaining that Charlie Kirk was assassinated at a school. There was an outcry from the community regarding the teacher's comments, with the Clay County School District receiving more than 500 complaints. The district had to increase security measures to ensure the safety of students and teachers, costing the district time and money and furthering the discomfort of the students in that district. Based on the evidence and investigation, this morning I found probable cause for four different charges. Number one, gross immorality. Number two, failure to protect the health, safety, and welfare of students. Number three, reduced effectiveness as an educator. And number four, failing to distinguish her personal views from that of a public educational institution. As a result, we will be seeking the revocation of this educator's license. Holding educators accountable for speech that celebrates violence in schools is not a violation of free speech. It is a necessary step to uphold the standards of the teaching profession and the safety of our schools.
Awesome. This is exactly what should happen. So the Florida Commissioner of Education, Anastasios Kamoutsas, joins me now. So I fully applaud this. We need more of this. Are you getting any pushback?
And, thank you for having me here. And yes, we are from the teachers union in particular, far left extremists who want to support an environment where somehow the celebration of violence in schools is now the new norm. I am shocked that we live in a day and age where people think it's okay to ever, I don't care who the individual is, to celebrate a school shooting. I am tasked as a commissioner of education with ensuring that we prioritize the health, the safety, and the welfare of all of our students. And for anyone, let alone educators, who are tasked with that same responsibility to celebrate this violence taking place in our schools, is totally inappropriate and it's not going to be tolerated.
That's so great. And I really appreciate the fact that one of the sanctions or one of these charges is grossly immoral conduct, because that needs to be an objective standard. This isn't just about censorship. It's not even about First Amendment, reasonable debate and discussion. This is an objective standard. So what does that look like in the state of Florida and for these types of sanctions specifically?
Sure. Well, gross immorality, typically look, any sanction in the state of Florida can range from a written reprimand or a letter of reprimand at the statewide level to a revocation of a license. But when you talk about grossly immoral statements, things that shock the conscience, where an individual cannot believe that this came out of the mouth of an educator, you are going to see an escalation in those penalties. And at a minimum, it typically ranges from a suspension, but it has gone all the way to the revocation of a license. Comments that are racist, comments that are disparaging of students. Look at the child that we charged gross immorality against the teacher who called the child a dictator and gave him that superlative and embarrassed him in front of his classmates simply because of his conservative values. We charged gross immorality in that case, and we are seeking the revocation of that educator's license, because this kind of conduct by those who are supposed to be role models to our children cannot be tolerated. If we allow this behavior to fester, it's only going to negatively impact the future generation of this country.
Yeah, so well said. And, you know, teachers are vested with the responsibility of protecting the health, safety, and welfare of students, and the also the effectiveness in the classroom. And so, you know, this is so important that teachers understand these boundaries. And so having, you know, this type of accountability is so important. But when you mentioned that the teachers' unions are opposing this, On what possible basis? Because, you know, what does this tell you, I guess, overall with how teachers' unions are protecting this vile and outrageous conduct and genuinely, I think, not caring about the student?
I agree. They've certainly lost their way. I think that they were originally created as a support system for educators to ensure a great education system where teachers are fulfilling the purpose of why they entered the profession, which is putting students first. As public servants, educators hold a special position of trust and responsibility. And I do want to be clear, because I was very fortunate that I had a lot of wonderful teachers in my life as I grew up through the Miami-Dade County public education system. And I think the overwhelming majority of Florida educators take this responsibility seriously, where they serve with integrity. They work tirelessly to foster trust and ensure that families feel safe and confident, and they send their children to school knowing that they're receiving a world-class education system. This is an example where a few bad apples are attempting to spoil the bunch, and I'm not going to let that happen. I fundamentally believe that educators serve a very important purpose in the lives of children, working together with parents to create a great educational learning environment. But with these posts and with this small number of educators having broken that trust, these individuals have to be held accountable. I'm sad to see that the teachers union is supporting such behavior. I think that not only does it put students in jeopardy, but it puts the very teachers that they purport to represent in harm's way when we allow a culture that celebrates violence in schools to continue. And that cannot happen. We need to make it very clear, this sort of behavior where a individual killed someone on a school campus is abhorrent. It cannot be the new norm. It cannot be tolerated. It cannot be glorified or celebrated. We have to do everything we can as a society to remind our youth that this is pure evil, and this is not how we deal with individuals who have differing opinions. In Florida, we uphold the First Amendment, we foster civil discourse and open dialogue in our schools, but this commitment does not extend to promoting or glorifying violence as a means of resolving that disagreement. And as these posts continue to circulate, more and more students are being exposed to the dangerous and false idea that violence is an acceptable response to differing beliefs. And that has no place in our education system.
So well said. I'm speaking to the Florida Commissioner of Education, that this is important because these teachers are molding and shaping young minds and students' minds. And when they step over that boundary of respectful dialogue and disagreement and legitimate debate into glorifying violence, that is a lesson that they are teaching their entire classroom and any other students that they come into contact with, that this is part of that acceptable debate and acceptable opinion. And so it's important to draw those distinctions. And so with Florida's guidelines and with the seeking these sanctions, are there clear guidelines so that educators know where the line is between personal free speech and then conduct that can risk certification, and how are those communicated? I mean, it should be obvious that glorification of violence is well beyond that threshold, but how are those guidelines communicated?
Sure. Look, educators go through certificate training in order to know what is expected of the profession. Obviously, they're guided by rules and statute that dictate what is, you know, the ethical and professional standards by which they are supposed to abide by. And so we have, you know, gross immorality, for example, the reduced effectiveness as an educator, the failure to protect the health, safety, and welfare of students. Like, these are things that should be commonsensical, where when you are inserting a personal view, for example, in a public educational institution, you've now gone beyond the fray of what is expected and teaching fact. You are now inserting an opinion. You are trying to indoctrinate these children. You're trying to push an ideology. And we have drawn the line there in Florida and said this is not acceptable. Similarly, with gross immorality, I hope that I don't have to put guidance out to educators saying, if you are, you know, making racist comments out there, even if it's on your private social media account, that is going to be used against you, and your community is not going to want you overseeing their children. If you're posting sexually explicit materials on your private social media account, that's something that you can probably expect to be used against you for purposes of a sanction on your teaching certificate. So, you know, we have general guidelines of what is and is not acceptable via statute and rule. But, you know, if I'm going to have to give a memo out for every single act that could or could not violate that, then I think we have a bigger issue with the profession.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just remarkable that we're in a society right now that anyone, much less a teacher, would need clear definitions or would be surprised that glorification of violence would result in these kinds of sanctions. I mean, I think back to, like, you know, the Anne of Green Gables kind of era, you know, and Little House on the Prairie and, like, the one-room schoolhouse and, you know, the community that was centered on church and family. And, you know, we didn't have this just complete contrast of worldviews where the left was out purposefully glorifying violence and trying to teach children that this is okay. And that, to me, Commissioner, speaks of a really insidious threat to our country and to our young people that is really worldview. And this is why Florida provides not only this accountability for teachers, but also options of protections for homeschooling, of you know, having a Christian education, for all of these different alternatives, so that parents can make sure that whether it's a publicly funded institution or it's homeschooling or anywhere else in between, that the indoctrination is not on a level of something that is so far from it really is not just American values, but westernized culture, correct, objectively truthful values.
That's correct. And something you indicated that I cannot emphasize enough, these are young, impressionable minds. These are developing brains that have not been fully developed. And so you don't know how they're going to take your statements, if they're going to take it for face value and be completely encouraged that now the role model that I'm in front of as a, you know, having this teacher who I highly respect is condoning this behavior, you don't know what kind of impact that's going to have on a child. To me, this is not an issue of left versus right. I can tell you if this heinous act had occurred on an individual who leaned left, we would have taken the same exact action. Celebrating violent acts in schools will never be tolerated so long as I'm the commissioner of education. And so this is not a left versus right issue. I fundamentally believe this is a right versus wrong issue, a good versus evil issue. And that's why I think it was appropriate to charge gross immorality, because this conduct is not just conduct unbecoming, but it is completely abhorrent, completely despicable to celebrate a school shooting. And it can't be done by those who are in charge of the health, safety, welfare of our students in schools.
Well, thank you so much for the work that you are doing to protect Florida students. And I hope that other states hear this and get on board. And if you're listening to this, reach out to your commissioner of education in your state if you don't have the privilege of living here in the free state of Florida, and encourage them to do the same. So you can follow Stassi Kamutsis on X. And as always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.